Hi, my name is Ken. I'm an alcoholic. Real happy to be here. It was interesting. We walked in and Stu was there and hadn't seen him in a while. And then there was Gal Debbie. And then they started talking about kissing in his basement. And I said, I better leave these two alone. You know, like it's interesting how at AA you can walk in anywhere and just hear this. Here, I mean, at least. So I'm real trying to intend it. And I thought I should have taken October as a month, too, because it's like it rhymes, you know, sober in October, you know, you know, it has a ring to it, you know, like it's sober in October. And it's nice to be here at the basketball court, and you guys must have, you know, the whole idea is to score. The deal here is you guys must have some pretty rough meetings when you keep luggage up front for the new people. You know, like these are, yeah, I should go to Pilgrim's Way. It's really happening over there. You know, like, you know, there's a story I like to tell. It's called the Murphy story. And some of you maybe know the Murphy story, but there was a guy by the name of Murphy, and he applied for a job in Dublin. And in order to get this job, he was competing with an American. And here he was in his own country, and he had the same experience as the American, and he had the same education as the American. And they each took a 10-question test, and they each only missed one. And they gave the job to the American. So Murphy went into the guy who owned the company, and he says, can't be understanding this. I'm in my own country. I'm on my own soil. I have the same education, the same experience. We each took a 10-question test, and we each only missed one, and you give the job to this bloke. And the owner of the company says, well, Murph, you're absolutely right. Everything you said is correct. You had the same education, and you had the same experience, and you only missed one on the test. He says, but it's the one you missed. He said, question number 5. He said, the American answered that question by saying, I do not know the answer to this question. And you answered your number 5 by saying, neither do I. And the deal is, neither do I. You know? And I've gone through a good bit of my sobriety with that. You know, neither do I, because people are looking for answers to questions that there are no answers for. I mean, something happens, and the first thing you hear somebody say is like, why? As though, like, oh, let me open the book. It's probably covered right here, you know. Let's turn to here, you know. And it's not that way. This is an owner's manual to help you live in the now. And the deal is that if you don't have an owner's manual, you should get it. And because otherwise it's like trying to swim with weights. You know, like this will help you a lot. And it's amazing that in life, most of us go through life talking about the way it used to be and the way it will be, but very few of us spend much time talking about the way it is. And the way it is the way it is. Heavy stuff. That's as deep as it gets, folks. You know, like, you know, I'm not scratching the surface. This is the surface, you know. Like, and the deal is that, you know, I hang out with guys and I'm with people who we figure sometimes that there are just some things you cannot change. And what we've come to notice is those things that we cannot change, we cannot change. And coming to that realization, we're able to proceed with life instead of trying to figure out why are we not changing this, you know? I went to a great meeting today. It was on the attitude of gratitude meeting, and that's what it's about. It's about your attitude. You know, it's not about what we're doing in life, it's how are we doing it. And people say, well, you know, I can't be happy right now. Okay, well, we'll wait. You know? You know? If you can't be happy right now, it's always right now. You know? Did you ever notice that? It can't be anything else but right now. There is nothing else but right now. There is no past, there is no future, there is right now. And you say, but the way it was, no. There was no was. There just is. And that scares a lot of folks, you know. Very few people want to live in the present, you know. But that's where life is played out. I sponsor a psychiatrist, and God love him, he's probably one of the slowest people I've ever encountered. You know, like that. You know, because everything is a why to him. I mean, his whole life is a why. You know, his whole life is you answer a question that you know no one knows the answer to, and then you proceed to give an opinion on something you don't know anything about in the hopes that you're close to the answer to the question that nobody asked. And he does this, you know, quite at ease, you know. And what really ticks him off right now is he doesn't have a key to the meeting hall. And we gave that to a guy who finished fourth grade. And he wants to know when he gets a key. And I said, well, we trust you, you know. And the guy who was trying to train him, who's in finished fourth grade, he said he's very difficult to work with. He says, every week he wants to know why we do the chairs this way. And he said, because that's the way we do them, you know. And why do we make the coffee this way? Because that's the way we do it. And he says, every week, he said, you'd think there'd be some carryover. You know, he comes in the next week, and he's at the same point again. Like, he's never been there before. Like, you know, deja vu, except this time it's Boujardet. You know, it's really happening. And so he, you know, it's always a matter of trying to figure things out. And I watch those folks, you know, they always look like they're in pain, you know. And they're trying to get some place that they can't get because they're here. You know? And somebody says, what's stress? I said, stress is real easy to define. It's being here and wanting to be there. Do you ever notice that? And if you don't like the image in the mirror, it does no good to break the mirror. You know, like, yeah, I don't like that. And you say, you know, it's just very interesting to watch people in action or in inaction usually. You know, I'm thinking about it. And I like the word thinking. I looked at it very closely one time, and I came to the realization that inside the word thinking is the word king. And people have made thinking king. And the reason they do that is because if you're thinking about something, then you don't have to be doing anything about it. Because you tell people, I'm collectively working on it. So next time you're thirsty, don't get a glass of water, just think about it, you know? Or you have to go to the head. I mean, it all depends how much crisis you can work with, you know? And the deal is, this is not about being smart, this is about being present and being conscious, and those are things that they talk about at length in the big book. There's a story told about a guy who, in 1939, ran into Albert Einstein on the campus at Princeton University. And at that time, he had already printed the theory of relativity and was considered the brightest, won the Nobel Prize, and was considered the brightest mind in the world by many. And this guy said, I'm going to stop him and ask him a question, just so later on in life I could say, I talked to Albert Einstein. So he stopped and he asked a question, and Albert Einstein just responded to it. And then as he started to walk away, the guy thought, wow, I got to talk to Albert Einstein. Albert Einstein said, excuse me, can I ask you a question? And he thought, Albert Einstein is going to ask me a question. He said, sure, go right ahead. And Albert Einstein says, when you first met me, was I coming from over here or over there? And the guy said, you were coming from over here. He said, oh, good, then I already had breakfast. You know? And that's the way life is. It's not about being bright. It's about being present. And there's a big difference between the two. The other word I looked at it a long time was the word spiritual. And inside the word spiritual is the word ritual. And if you want to be spiritual, you do a ritual. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, we seem to know what that ritual is. It seems to be of love and service, you know. And if you're doing service, it's amazing how when you're preoccupied with someone else, you're very seldom occupied with yourself. Someone was sharing an experience today of taking someone to a hospital or a recovery place. And like, you can be so intent in your own life, and you get an alcoholic in your car who you're taking, let's say, to the hospital, who has lost control of their bowels and some of their other bodily functions. And suddenly, the cares of the day just go away. You know, like,
Yeah. You're just saying, please, God, not tonight.
You know, I really don't want to do this. And you're hoping, like, just sit there. I mean, sit. That's where the, you know. You know? And the deal is that you don't really have any place else in your mind at the moment except being right there with that guy. And the bottom line is that's why the folks who wrote this owner's manual knew that. They knew that you could not be involved with working with someone else and be so intent on yourself that you were screwing up your own life. And what happens is, this is a program of doing the ritual. And I don't know about you guys, but it means every day. And it means about waking up. You know, in this book, they talk a lot about becoming conscious. And it says things like, burn into the consciousness of the newcomer that they can stay sober regardless. You know, as you become conscious of his presence, you'll lose your fear of today, tomorrow, and the hereafter. Try to form a conscious contact with God as you understand him. And you're beginning to feel the consciousness of your belief in step 10. And what that means is, wake up. You know, like you're asleep. You know, you're walking around banging in the walls. It's great. Huh? This looks very familiar. It seems I've done this 600, 700, 800 times, you know, and wondering why it always comes out the same way. And in the big book and in the 12 and 12, they talk about the spiritual axiom, you know, like whenever you're feeling bad, regardless of the cause, it's our deal. And there's a life axiom, and the life axiom is, which parallels that, is that if you don't know what to do, you will do what you know. And that means you'll be doing the same thing over and over and over again. And, you know, and you watch some people and they're like wind-up toys, you know. And then they look at you at that look like, funny, it's just like last time. You know? And that's why I love to go to AA meetings, because you have to realize that this is our best effort. You know, I mean, this is it. This is it. You know, I like Dr. Silkworth. Silky's in the big book here, and he talks about us in like, you know, very, very specific terms. He says we're maladjusted to life. We're in full flight from reality. We're outright mental defectives. Children of chaos, producers of confusion. Need I go on? And within the context of that, we're trying to form a healthy person life. Yeah, and me. But not today, you know. And the deal is that when someone says to you, maybe you need to be restored to sanity, you take it as a personal offense, you know. Like, why would you say that? As you're in some kind of a jacket, you know. Why do you think I need to change? You know? Because maybe it's just not happening real good for you. And the deal is, that's why I love to come to these things, because I love to watch people laugh, because I know some basic things about laughter, and that is, you cannot laugh and think at the same time. So every time you laugh just a little bit, you can't think. And for an alcoholic, that's like a gift, you know, like it's like a special Hallmark card comes in the mail saying, no thinking. Wow. How long, you know? Okay, it's over. You know? You don't want to get used to it, you know? And I love going on retreats with a bunch of guys, because it's amazing sometimes. You go on retreats and people say, well, what should I be doing here? It's always got to be functional. And so what I try to tell them is, when I'm the retreat guy, I say, look, try to do what you wouldn't ordinarily be doing. You know, if you like to read, don't read. If you never get a chance to read, go read. If you haven't climbed a tree in a while, go climb a tree. You know, if you haven't been for a walk, go take a walk. Go do something you haven't done before. And, you know, you get this look like, well, I've never done that, you know. And it's like, okay, well, then just do what you do, you know. And the reality is folks want to change, but they don't want to do any different habits. And it's the amazing thing that in order to form a habit, you have to repeat an act. And that's why we have these spiritual principles that, hey, you go and you do this stuff. And the nice part about it is they talk about it in specific terms in the book. On page 132, it says specifically, you know, that we're not a glum lot. we're not a glum lot. We absolutely insist on enjoying life. You meet a lot of those? So, are you insisting on enjoying life, you know? And you look on page 132, and it's like a work of art, because there's 33 lines on page 132. And if you come down 16 from the top and up 16 from the bottom, that's right in the middle. It's two words in from the left and two words in from the right. It's as though the guys who wrote this said, this is the centerpiece, you know? We absolutely insist on enjoying life. And then for the folks who are a little remedial, on page 133 it says, you know, we know that God wants us to be happy, joyous, and free. And when you read that sentence, there are 12 words in that sentence, one for each step. So if you want to be happy, joyous, and free, you do the ritual. What's the ritual? I insist on enjoying life. How do I do that? Living in the now. How do I live in the now? Be of service to someone else. I've never done that. And it's like, what's in the kids, you know, on the merry-go-round? He'll be back. Don't worry. He'll be back. And the Al-Anons have a program that they just sit here and he'll be back. And you can always tell when an alcoholic is ready to really get into the mainstream, because, you know, it's like our theme song is doop 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 doop. And then it's like, okay, go meet somebody. You know? Boom, you know? And a buddy of mine got married 2 weeks ago, and it's his fifth marriage, so I think he needs the rice, you know. But the deal is, you know, the only thing they have in common is neither one of them were raised by wolves. And you just sit there and you go, And those of us who know them and love them say, you know, like, it's her first wedding, so she thinks it's for real. You know, like, you're watching her, like, you know, her family didn't know her, they're not in AA, you know, and they think, like, this is keeps, this is forever. And the mother was crying, and the father was crying. It's like, she's 34, she's never been married. He's 52, he's been married 5 times. You know, like, don't worry, anything she doesn't know, he'll teach her, you know, like. But it's like when we get married, we have these special wedding vows, you know. It says, like, for better, for worse, for richer and poorer, in good times and in health, until death do us part. And the alcoholic says, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no. Come on, baby, let the good times roll. You know? Oh, I can see some problems. Yeah? And the deal is that, and you go and you watch all this happening, and you realize that it's not only happening here, it's outside too. The thing is, we just talk about it more. You know, like, I love it in meetings when people say, well, the normal people. Watch my lips. There are no normal people. There are just folks who haven't shared with you. If they shared with you, you'd say, here's a meeting list, you know, like, you know, and the deal is, you know, like, normal people, next time you're in the store, they're buying things like mint-flavored dog biscuits. Mint-flavored dog biscuits, you know. I want my dog to have good breath, I'll put Lavoris in the toilet, you know, like, the normal people, you know, there just aren't any. I mean, I'm sorry. You know, you stand next to people in line and you just listen to them talk and you say yes, yes, You want a white chip? And the deal is you learn to have all kinds of fun because you realize. There is. You know, once you realize this is all there is, then you can get down to doing this is all there is. And instead of getting all caught up in all this other stuff that goes on. And sometimes the treatment just isn't real good. You know, sometimes it's just the way life works out. You know, it's like Rodney Dangerfield used to talk about when he had a friend who went to the doctor, and the doctor says he was terminally ill and he gave him a week to live. And he says, "Doc, is there anything I can do?" He says, "No." He says, "You got a week to live." He says, "There must be something." He said, "Okay." He says, "Mud baths. Take a lot of mud baths." He said, "Oh, will that help?" He says, "No, but we'll get you used to the dirt, you know?" The deal is, you know, sometimes the answer just isn't really good, you know? And when people have problems, or what they perceive to be problems, and what you're telling them is not what they want to do, so they're not going to listen to what to do, because that's not what they want to do, because then if they do it, the problem would be resolved, and then they'd have nothing to really work on. And it's like when you get here, you know, everybody basically is carrying around who they are. And if you take that away from them, it gets scary, because then they want to know, who am I really, you know, like... And the deal is that you find out after a while that this is all there is, and it's a lot of fun to live in the now. You know, I used to do drive-bys. You know, I would drive by the now when I was married and stuff, and I would say, "Oh, yeah, you know, that's what it looks like." You know, like, wow, can you imagine doing that full-time? You know, like, wow, that would be heavy stuff. And I would have these conversations. I married a woman. We were married for 22 years. She was the most sound person I could have married. There was not a, you know, she didn't have a thought out of whack. She was just right in the moment. And, you know, here I was, you know, Buzzley Berkeley. I was, you know, doing this thing around the world, and I'd land every now and again just to see how the earth people would do. And she'd think I was there because I was sitting there. And she used to think if I was physically there, I was there. And, you know, I could be there but never be there. You know, I was swimming in the Ganges or going, you know, climbing a mountain or... You know, trying to make up a story about a story that didn't happen. And then how I was there, but I couldn't have been there because it happened before my time, so I had to modernize it. You know, like, now I could be there. You know, like, and so you had to have all these facts because you knew people were going to ask all these questions, and when you told the story, nobody noticed. And there you are with a lot of information that you've made up that has absolutely no application into anything. And so I used to have these discussions with her. You know, she woke me up one night and she said, "There's somebody outside." And I said, "Good, that's where they belong, outside." You know, like, when, you know, that's why we have an outside, you know. When they come inside, give me a hug, you know, we'll get up and we'll do something about this, you know. And then another time she said, "You know, I wake up. And I woke up and she says, "I had this terrible dream that you took me out to the desert and you left me there." And I said, "Oh, honey, just let me go back to sleep, and I promise to pick you up first thing in the morning." You know, like, so we were, like, communicating, you know. And she was in the real world, and I didn't even know what the real world looked like. You know, I was just a drive-by. You know, I just drove by. And so when I got sober and people began to say to me, "You know, we do this one day at a time, and we do it in the now, and we try to get conscious because we're unconscious, and you have to practice surrender a lot." And surrender to me meant you just were given in. You're given into it. I thought surrender had a terrible word. It was a terrible word to begin with because I didn't mind being captured. I just didn't want to be surrendered. You know, that was my deal. And I noticed, too, that my thinking was out of whack. Like, you know, Julie has 35 years of sobriety. In AA, one of the first things I noticed was people counted up. You know, like, he has 2 years. She has 5 years. This person has 8 years. I thought, wow. I came from a world where we counted down. You know, in a year I'll get my license back. You know? In 6 months the divorce is final. You know, in 3 months I come up for parole. You know, like, everything was, you know, we counted down. And in AA they were counting up. They were happy to be doing what they were doing. You know, and I used to think, well, why would you want to tell somebody you're 8 years sober? You know, what a hellish thing. It would scare the average person, you know, like, particularly if they knew you, you know, like, can you imagine going up to some old barroom friend and putting your hand, "Hey, guess what, I'm a year sober, and I don't come here anymore, I'm just happening to be here now to let you know that I'm not going to be here anymore, you know, and that's why I thought I'd show up tonight to let you know, I'm not drinking, Joe, put down that beer, I'm not drinking, and, you know, I'm, okay, Sparky, you know, we get the message. And the deal is that we moved into a new way of life. And the new way of life is living one day at a time. And that means surrendering. And, you know, there's a grief in every person's life. They go through certain griefs. Could be divorce, could be loss of a job, could be loss of a loved one, could be anything. And that grief is so deep that there's absolutely no words for it. You can't talk about it really at any level with anybody, and it's so deep you can't do anything about it. And yet the pain of it goes on day after day after day. And you realize that if you luck out, you realize at some point that the unacceptable has got to become acceptable. And that's a rock and a hard place, when the unacceptable has to become acceptable. In the book, it talks about pain being the touchstone of all spiritual growth. And I thought it meant the more pain you had, the more spiritual you were. No. I was wrong. I was really wrong. It's not about that. It's about the pain will lead you to accept that which is unacceptable. And when you accept that which is unacceptable, it's called surrender. And that's what leads you to spiritual growth, because when you surrender, you stop resisting the world as God has it, and you start living in that moment, and that's the spiritual growth. The spiritual growth is when I'm in the moment, when I'm in this moment, and I'm not resisting what's going on around me. It's like just the way it is. My son gave me a great compliment a couple of weeks ago. I think it was a compliment. He said, "Dad, you've reached the point, doesn't matter," because we were talking about flying and all the things going on. And he said, "Dad, you don't have to worry. No matter who has the gun, you always had the bullets." And I thought, yeah, you know, put down that thing. Don't be such a pest, you know. And the deal is that that's right, that if you surrender in every moment, then there's really nothing to be worried about. When I hear people share at meetings, and they share about resentment, I realize they have too much past in their present. And when they're worried and about the future, they have too much fear in their present. And so the secret here is to have more present in your present. And that means to start to live in a state of isness. And a lot of people, you know, would rather live in Boston. You know, and the deal is when you live in the moment, you realize there's no problems in the moment. The problems are always yesterday's problems, or the problems you think tomorrow. Right now, this moment, there isn't a person in here, if you're in the now, has a problem. Doesn't mean you don't have situations in your life. You just don't have a problem. And the deal is that you can make one up. Don't worry. Oh, you know, you'll have time. And you can make it into whatever you want. And the deal is that as it goes on, you'll realize, you know, this is my own deal. I'm making this up. And the bottom line is that you can take a lot of nows and just tick them away and use them almost like a waiter. You become a professional waiter. Like, well, in 2 years when Joe's out of school, that's when I'll leave that bastard. When John is through educating, I'll do this. And when Mary does this, I'll do this. And your whole life becomes that of a waiter, you know. In the meantime, these nows are just going by. And what you're doing is you're trading off this now for some make-believe thing out there. And so the deal is for me is that I hang out with guys that, you know, I have a guy who had trouble staying in the now, so I gave him a rubber band, and I said, every time you find yourself drifting, just snap it, you know. And he wears it on his wrist. Now he's gotten fanatical. See, alcoholics can get fanatical. He has two, one on each hand. So in case this one breaks, he won't forget the now with this one, you know. And then he always, like, when the one breaks, he goes and renews the one that broke, so he always has two, it, you know, at the same time. And the deal is that you just never know what's going to happen. And you start to have a house that's really entertaining because people see who come to where you live. And my neighbors, they have no idea what goes on. Women come in all hours of the night. Look very excited. They don't know it's for coffee. And then guys come and they all look so different. You know, three-piece suit guys and guys that look like they just, you know, they broke out of the penitentiary somewhere. And guys are, you know, born to kill, love to hate, really want to see you, you know. That kind of stuff. You know, who's that? Ah, he's a chairperson, you know. And so they don't understand. And people send you people. That's the best part. You know, people send you people. And this guy
during the football, Monday night football, they know that we get pizza and we kind of hang out at my house. So he sent this guy over and he knocks at the door. My sponsor sent me over here to talk to you. Okay, about what? He said, about God. I said, oh, great, we got 11 minutes, you know? And I have a buddy, Sam, and Sam is Persian, which means he comes from Iran. And so at the football games, we call him Hector, so there's no... with all that flag stuff going on. Hector, you want to get some coffee? You know. And so Sam comes there, and of course it's sundown when he gets there, so he prays. So this guy comes in and sits on the couch, and I forgot to tell him Sam was in the other room. And so all of a sudden out of the other room we hear, whoa, 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 whoa. And he says, what the hell is that? And I said, oh, it's Sam doing his third step, you know. And he left. And to be honest with you, I haven't seen him since. And I called his sponsor, and he hasn't seen him either. He said, what the hell happened? I said, I don't know. He just heard Sam, and he got a little excited and left. And so you just never know what's going to happen, you know. But the nice part about it is... I think in 11 minutes we gave him a good orientation, you know, like with the time allotted, I think we got maximum output, you know what I mean? And I just figure, you know, somewhere down the line he's going to be somewhere and they're going to say, you know, God as you understand him, and he's going to stand up and go, whoa, 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 whoa. And I think, what the hell happened to this guy, you know? And you do some things in early sobriety that, you know, when you get here, you can be fanatical. I was fanatical when I got here. And you do some things, and they live with you forever. No matter what else you do, that's what people will remember you doing. Was, remember you did that, you know. And when I was newly sober, I had a sponsor who's still my sponsor. You know, he's been, I had a temporary sponsor. He's been my sponsor now for 30-plus years. And who knows if it's going to work. You know. But the deal is he used to invite me over to his house because when I first got sober, my wife and kids had moved away because they needed to have some serenity and some sanity. And I would go to his house and he would give me dinner and I would hang out there. And he never asked me to do anything. And I got sober back in New York in Brooklyn. And in Brooklyn, they don't do 12-step work. They say, go put the hit on this guy. You know, pick him up. They also say things like, hey, fell asleep in the trunk of a car, he deserved to be shot. You know, like, so it's one of those kind of neighborhoods. There's no mafia, but they live in our neighborhood, you know? And the deal was, is when you tell somebody you're going to do something in that environment, you do it. And that's the way I grew up. I knew how to make commitments in certain areas. And when you made them, that's the way it was. And I remember saying to my sponsor, you know, I'd like to do something. He says, good, you're staying sober, you're 3 weeks, you're 4 weeks, you're 5 weeks, you know, and you're coming to meetings, you're doing all the right things. And one night he says, we got to go put the hit on this guy. So we went and we drove down this street. It was a typical brownstone in Brooklyn, and we drove down there, and we couldn't find a parking space, which was very typical. And he says, I'll drive around the block, go get him and bring him out to the car. Well, as he tells the story, when he came back, I had the guy on the ground, and I'm beating him with a garbage can lid, you know. And the reason being is when I got to the door, he had decided, as though he had a choice, like he didn't want to go. And so he said, I've changed my mind, and hey, pal, you know. This is the first time this A&A asked me to do anything. I'm not going to screw it up, you know? So, get your ass out here in a hurry. And he was still talking like he had, like, control, you know? And his wife was going, he doesn't have to go if he doesn't want to. And so, I felt what he needed was some active recruiting, you know? So I kind of snagged him through the door, and the garbage can lid was there, and the next thing you know, they were being introduced to one another. And it's an amazing deal, because when my sponsor came back and he saw this, he looked, and it was like I was a retriever. He beeps the horn, and I run to the car, and I get in the car, and we drive for about 3 or 4 blocks, and he says, do me a favor. I said, what's that? And he says, I want you to do 2 things for me. I said, okay. He said, number one, don't ever consider that a 12-step call. You know? And number two is, don't tell anybody I'm your sponsor for a while. Let's, you know, let's see how it goes, you know? And the deal is I still hear about that today, and I can tell you standing here right now that the guy who did that, I killed. The guy who did that could not stay sober. The guy who had that kind of anger just wasn't going to stay here and be happy, joyous, and free. So I had to kill that guy. And I killed him deliberately through taking the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's how I killed that guy, because I couldn't survive. Had I not killed that guy, he would have killed me, because he was this make-believe thing, and I had to support him in what he wanted to do because I didn't know I had a choice. And in Alcoholics Anonymous, by taking these steps, they allowed me to not only to kill him, but allowed me to get introduced to a whole new way of life. Now, I still take a kidding when I go back to Brooklyn. Let me tell you. I go to the same meeting, and, hey, Kenny, how you doing? You beating anybody? Oh, you know? Yeah. And then now it's been like an AA story. They, you know, how when people have 30 years to work on something, they do a job on you, you know? And they'll come in and they'll, you know, you'll be eating dinner and if you think that's all behind you and you're visiting friends and like, you know, socializing, and they'll come in, you know, I was in the bar the other night. There was this guy there. They said, wow, he was so drunk and so loud and so boisterous, you couldn't believe it. And the bartender says to him, you ought to call AA. And this guy had garbage can lid marks on his face. And he said, I tried it. It didn't work for me, you know. I didn't need to call him again, you know. And they make up these terrible stories, like I dragged them behind the car and I put them in the garbage can and I rolled them to the meeting, and, you know. And the bottom line is, that guy had to die. And I was glad to kill him, because when he died, I got a chance to live. And that was the beginning of living for me, was when I had killed this guy off. And I got to live every day of my life, which I get to live today. And I get to do a lot of fun things that I would have never gotten to do otherwise. I mean, I have a life. And that life consists of Alcoholics Anonymous as a centerpiece of it, and then allows me to go and do everything else. And the deal is I just have to do certain rituals to keep this spiritual way of living. And in between, you get a chance to work with some really, really great people. I mean, they're just so, their ideas are so creative, you know, like, and you realize there's more than one way to make change for a dollar, you know, and AA, you know, you find that out. People come up with stuff I wouldn't have thought of in a million years. And it's like, wow, that's pretty good. And I remember when I got back with my wife, even her thinking began to kind of rub off a little bit, you know, and she would say things now, and I would say, I think I heard that, you know. And I remember we were back together just a short time, and there was a party next door, 4th of July, and people had said, well, we're only going to be there till 10 o'clock, Ken, and then we're going to break it up. And it was like 1, and they were still going. So, you know, I know how to get people's attention, and so I said, okay, I think I'll go over and talk to them. And so and my wife said, why don't we just call the police? You mean and tell them where we are? And, you know? And she said, yeah, and this is something they can take care of. So I called the police, reluctantly. And the guy said, where are you located, and what's your address, and blah, and they came over, and they talked to the folks, and everything kind of just worked out. And then week later at the meeting, I remember sharing that, saying, you know, well, there was sharing how the program works in my life. Answering question number 5. They said, boy, Ken, that was quite a deal over at your house, huh? Yeah, yeah, but I knew what to do. I called the police, and they handled it. My sponsor said, it must be nice to have your wife back.
you know. And the deal is that today I move a lot slower than I used to move. You know, when I was in my 20s, 30s, 40s, and 50s, I was a pit bull. You know, I was in, if you were doing it, I was in the middle of it. And if I wasn't in the middle, I was working my way to the center as quickly as I could get there. And now I'm not a pit bull anymore. Now I'm Lassie. You know, I go for help, you know, like I, instead of being the help, I go get help, you know, I'll be right back, hold on, you know, and I know how to do that now, you know, and I never knew how to do that before, you know. I was always standing up when someone said, shut up, and I always used to get them confused, and I'd be in the emergency room at 2 a.m. and somebody would be resetting my nose or putting stitches in my mouth, and I'd be saying something like, yeah, at least I didn't work away, you know. And that guy was home sleeping, you know, and people would wonder where I was. And the reality of all of that today is that guy had to die. And I'm glad to say I killed him. And if you know anybody today who's suicidal and they say, hey, I, you know, definitely want to die, then tell you, look, you're in the right place. We can help you. Let's get you started on these steps right away. Because when someone is suicidal and they say they want to die, what they're really saying is the pain of this world is so great that I can't take it anymore. And they're also saying that I don't see a way out. I just don't see a way out. And this is a way out. And so we're like, you know, we're like people who are standing on a whale fishing for minnow. You know, we just don't realize what we have here, you know, and until somebody stops and really says to you, you know, you're pretty lucky to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous. And everybody in this room is sober to be lucky and lucky to be sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, because that gives you an introduction to the present. And this is where the game is played. And you can be, you know, do that delusional stuff now and again. But, you know, you eventually realize, hey, you know, I can't live out here. I just can't live out here. And you get to have a lot of laughs, and you listen to all the language that's made up. You know, I have no problem with language that people bring in from other places. Some of it's pretty good, but one of the words that was brought in a while back was denial. You know, it was like denial. People started using the word, I'm in denial. Joe's in denial. He's in denial. And denial is a nice word, but it's not an alcoholic word. And it's not a word you use in the big book. The word they use in the big book is delusional. Delusional. Now, you look up the word denial in the Webster Dictionary, it says something like someone who knows the truth and just doesn't want to share it. That's not the alcoholic word. Look up the word delusional. It says psychotic thought. You know, where the individual involved has no clue as to the truth. You know, they wouldn't know the truth if it was mugging them. You know, like they just don't know. So when you hear somebody say denial, that's really spiritual growth. You know, they're moving along. If you're consciously in denial, it's like you're just a liar. You know, that's a lot different than being psychotic. You know, in full flight from reality and outright mental defective, you know. And alcoholics, we're so grandiose, you know. We always want to be at the center of something and be there humbly. You know? You know, like, oh, no, it's really not me. I just arrived, you know. And I think of when we found out in New York that Silkworth, the doctor in the big book, was buried in New Jersey. We found out where his grave was. He's buried in West Long Branch, New Jersey, which is about 45 minutes out of the city. So we said, well, we'll go over there on his birthday, which I think is in July sometime, and we'll go over and we'll just read the doctor's opinion, take the big book, read it. Bunch of guys, 2 carloads of guys, we went from our meeting, and we'll read it, and we'll thank Silky for what he did, and then we'll go home, have breakfast and go home. No big deal. So that's what we did the first year. The second year, people heard about it and said, we'd like to go, we had more people. So now we had like maybe 8 carloads of people. Well, Silky's grave is a little tiny, like a real small cemetery. It's like a, you know, like a partial cemetery. And it's like not that many people buried there. And it's a small town, West Long Branch, New Jersey, down on the shore. And there's a big old rotten apple tree above his grave. And a headstone from the kids playing or the ground given or whatever was tilted over. So after 3 or 4 years and the crowd getting bigger and bigger, it was like, well, we're going over there the day before. Well, what are you going to do? We're going to rake, because those apples around the tree
cause people to have to stand in that. So we'll rake that up. Okay. Then a year or so later, it was, we need a canopy, because in case it rains, you know. And then it's, some of the women wear heels, and they would like to sit, so we need folding chairs. And then it was like, why don't we raise the headstone? And then why don't we chop down the, you know, the apple tree? And why don't we just get Suki up, you know, like, what the hell, you know? You know, we'll just keep going, you know? And the deal is, it keeps getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Somehow, you know, we think that bigger is better. And I always think of the guys that, you know, that started this thing. You know, I remember speaking, in fact, not far from here with Dr. Bob at one of the functions, one of the state functions that you folks had. And I remember him sharing at that time, Bob Smith's son, young Bob, and he shared, he said, you know, if Bill Wilson had done this thing on his own, it would be franchised like McDonald's. There'd be AA clubs on every corner and somebody'd be getting paid some money. He said, if my dad was left alone, we'd still be meeting in a basement in Akron, you know. But together they were a perfect blend, because what they did was, it was like the yin and the yang, you know, Bill and the Bob, you know. And the deal was, and Billin' and Bobbin', you know. And the deal was is that one guy would come up with something grandiose and the other guy would kind of put it under the modifier, you know, and he'd modify it a little bit. And the deal with Alcoholics Anonymous, as you look at it today, is just amazing. We sometimes have no idea what's going on. At least I don't. Maybe you guys have access to this. But my friend Sam just came back from being in Iran, and he was there for about two months. And AA is about 5 years old now in Iran. And they're very fundamentalist. You got to remember, they went through the Khomeini period, and now they're in the Mullah period. And as he's quick to point out, under Islamic law, men and women do not go to temple together. But yet, here in Iran, the capital of all this nonsense just a few years back, men and women are going there for AA meetings. He says, and there he is sitting in the main mosque in the middle of Iran, with women who are uncovered. He said, these beautiful women who really know a lot about makeup, because the only thing they get to show is their face. And he said, these stunning women, and he said, they're really taking a chance, because there was a time if they went there, that, you know, that would be the end of them. They were breaking Islamic law. And here they were now sitting there at AA meetings, 75, 100 people in a meeting, and trying to find their way through Alcoholics Anonymous. And he says, above us, hanging in a 25-foot drop cloth, is a picture of the Khomeini. He said, the Khomeini's probably saying, what the hell happened? I've only been out of there a couple of years, you know. Why did you allow these folks to get in here, you know? And the deal is, as you talk to people back from China, the same thing's going on in China. The Chinese government doesn't know what to do, because they have a law that when three or four people meet, if there's more than three of you that meet, you have to give notification, because they're concerned with rebellion. So they got AA where people are meeting and they're breaking the law openly, anonymously, and they got this other stuff going on. And you think, this is Alcoholics Anonymous in action. It's like everywhere. You know, it's like that. It's like everywhere. And you just kind of take it for granted in this country, for the simple reason that you can go anywhere and bump into a meeting. I mean, we got like 5,000 meetings in San Diego County. And you say, my gosh, you could go to a men's woman, a meeting woman, a meeting and not sure. You know, like, you can go to anything you want. You know, and the deal is that, and you can just find this thing. And as the reason for going is that, everywhere you look right now is people are deciding that this is a great way to live. And they come to our meetings, they're in for a hoot, because I tell you, we have guys at the door who, you know, if I was coming there for the first time and they wanted me to shake their hand, trust me, I'd shake their hand, you know. Because they're like, hey, yo, get over here, I want to shake your hand, you know. Then they give you a big smile, welcome, you know. You know, it's like Halloween, except it's always Halloween, you know. It's like, you know. You know, it's like last year we had a Halloween dance at our home group, and you came dressed as your favorite character defect. Well, you know, and I never realized there were so many different variances of lust. You know, like, I thought, wow, I was so glad I was on the judging committee, because it was like, wow. And the deal is that
I've been here long enough now to tell you this with a great deal of confidence, and that is that I have never seen anyone come into Alcoholics Anonymous who thoroughly gave it a shot that did not only stay sober but had a great life. Now, it tells you in the literature it will take time for some people, because some people have, they've so identified with who they aren't that they don't know who they are. And so if they were to give up right away who they aren't, they don't know who they are yet. And sooner or later, you'll find out who you are is much better than who you're pretending to be, because the person you're pretending to be is very inadequate because it's not your full effort. And it's not your full effort because that's not who you are in the first place. So if you try to be who you are instead of who you're not, then you'll be okay. And that's really the first couple of steps, you know? And saying along the way, you know, I don't always get it, but I'm always here, you know? And that's the nice part about it, is you get to have a lot of laughs as you go along the way. I mean, just look around at the people in this room. I mean, would we be people who ordinarily on a Saturday night would go to a church hall to hear some yo-ho from California get up and talk? No, we'd be out there having fun. Where is it? I think it's over there on Sunshine and Boulevard, you know. We never knew where fun was, but we were always in hot pursuit, you know. And then the next day you were exhausted, drunk, and penniless. You never found fun, but somehow it found you and took total advantage of you, you know. And you'd say, after a while, you would think you would just get the message. And I never got the message. I mean, I can remember being in a lockup on a Saturday night and looking around and saying things like, because I was delusional. Look at this. This is the same guy who was here last week. And look at this guy. I mean, you'd think some of these guys would just learn, you know? It never came into my mind that I was there, you know? I had this filtering device that it never got through to me that the reason I knew who these yahoos were because I was a yahoo, you know? And the nice part about that today is I know most of the time that I don't know. And knowing I don't know leaves the door open for me finding out. And I have a lot of fun in the process. I mean, I get to do a lot of things that, you know, that some people, if you told them what you did for fun, they'd look at you and say, well, maybe you didn't get to that second step, you know? You know, I got to give diplomas out at the drunk driving school. And these are people who are arrested, and if they stay clean and sober for 15 months, they have their record expunged, and it's called alternative sentencing. And the cops who arrested them come to the graduation, and they have a graduation book. It's what they look like the night they got picked up and what they look like now. And, I mean, it's amazing. Some of the gals, like, had no teeth and one eye, and, you know, like... And mascara that could, like, you know, like, look like they were playing Cochise in a movie, you know, like, down around here. And the guys look so debonair, you know. And then you get to see them, and when they give you the certificate, they call you up, and you get a little piece of paper saying that you did the deal, and you get a T-shirt that says, I've been expunged. And, you know, and the cop who arrested you is there, and they had a guy, I'm sure you'll get to hear this guy sooner or later, because they only let him talk for like a minute, and he said, I knew God was working in my life because God appeared to me the first night, and it was the officer over there who arrested me. His name is Angel Fernandez. And so I knew I had an angel in my life right away, you know. And you watch the cops going, thank God they're here, you know, like that. Thank God they're here. And then, they signed the yearbook to one another. Mary, good luck. Don't use crack, you know. Betty, don't sell crack, you know. And it's like all these great things, and you realize this is a great way to spend the night. And you sit next to the people who are on the county, work for the county government are there, and the lawyers, the judges who sentenced them are there if they can make it. And you say, what a wonderful thing. Life is really, really a great thing. And it's so fragile, and we found that out not too long ago. You know, I was due to fly out that morning to go see my brother who was having open-heart surgery, and I couldn't get out that day. And my son and I talked about that event in New York, and
In 1973, we were getting ready to come to California. My family and I still lived in New York, and I went to see that building when it was completed, both towers. And when they built that, when they built the Twin Towers initially, it was the first time they had ever used hydraulic cranes. And these are cranes that lock onto the corner of the building and raises itself up. And then the last day that they were there, they had Chinook helicopters come and take them off, and then they put the roof on. And I went over there with the kids, and we watched this, and it was like, wow, this is fantastic. Two Chinook copters came and took the one crane off, and then later on they came back and took the other crane off. And you say, wow, this is so exciting. And that was in 1973, so you figure that's what, 28 years ago outside. And I look at my own life since then. I had stayed at my mom's house, and my mom is now dead. The gal I was married to at the time, she and I have been divorced. She's been remarried 20 years, and her husband now is dying of bone cancer. And she moved back. Her and my husband-in-law bought a place right near me. And I have two sisters that are dead, a brother who's dead, and one of those children that I took to see that are dead. So life is very, very fragile, and it's so very moment to moment. And, you know, if you're sitting here tonight, and if I have any message at all to give you, it's start living this moment, because, you know, you don't want to waste them. They're too precious. And you notice how quickly they go by. You know, I think the first time I met Julie, she was coming up on 25 years, and now it's 35 years. How that 10 or 11 years just go by. Maybe it was even 12 years ago. And Ted, the same way, you know, calling me on Tuesday night for 12 years or whatever, and it's getting better, I think, you know. Well, Bill Wilson said it's an honest program. It seems to be getting better. Okay. And the deal is that, you know, you just realize that this moment is not to be wasted. So even if your life situation is kind of upsetting right now, just remember that it's going to be different. It's going to all be different. And the thing is that your worrying about it isn't going to change any of it. You know, that's the nice part about it. And that nobody chooses to be depressed or dysfunctional or in relationships that are punishing. You know, you're like married to Muhammad Ali, you know, like, you know, the thing is that we're just not awake. We're just not awake. And what this program does is it helps us to get awake. And in the process of getting awake, things get a lot easier. And as I said, you get to laugh a lot. You know, if you're not laughing a lot, then you're missing out on the world's biggest joke, which is you. You know, you know, like life's a joke and we're the punchline. And if we miss that punchline, you know, it's like amazing. And it has really nothing to do with your situation. I remember my son when he was dying, and we had to take him to the hospice, and he died in the very hospice where I was volunteering. And I remember him, we had taken him off of drugs, and he didn't know he was in hospice because he was in an ICU unit at a hospital, and they moved him into the hospice. And when he woke up, he looked at me and he wanted to know, where am I, Dad, and what's going on? And I said, well, you're in the hospice. And he knew from me working there what that meant. And he rolled his head to one side of the pillow, and he was in this world when he did that. And when he came back, he looked at me and he said, I'm okay with this. I'm okay with this. I'm good to go. I'm good to go. And you and his mom was there, and my husband-in-law, and he said, and you guys got to go on with your lives. And I heard that very clearly. And that's one of those griefs that has, I've moved on from it, but the pain of it is with me every single day. And I don't mean the pain in the sense that I'm reliving it. I'm meaning in that it has taught me such a valuable lesson. And that lesson is, from that day to this day, I've been working as hard as I can to be good to go. And I'm good to go anytime now. I don't owe anybody anything. You know, I've made my amends. I'm clear with the world. I'm long past my shelf life. You know, like, and what I notice going by the mirror in the morning is that there's a part of me, the outside of me, is dying every day. But through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and a loving God, the inside of me is being renewed on a daily basis. renewed on a daily basis, and I feel fresh inside. Inside, I still feel like a pit bull. I know I'm a collie, but I remember now, I'm conscious. But I don't get caught up in that stuff. And I know that people are doing the best they can do. And I've come to accept that. It's not like, you know, it's not like somebody's made a serious attempt to ruin my day. It's just that they're doing the best they can with what they have. And you get to laugh at all the at the funny things. You know, I tell the story where I was in line at the store, and I had been shopping, and the guy, I don't know whether people just like me or what, but this guy says, "I can take you down here." And so I casually started to walk over to where he was, and a woman who knew that she was ahead of me kind of just bore down with this cart. And I could see her coming out of the corner of my eye. And, you know, and she didn't look like there was a stop sign in her life, you know. And so I pulled my cart out, and I go, "Come on, come on," you know. And I said, "Get in there, get in there. You got to get going, you know. Be first, get first, you know. Go there." And she went in a little sheepishly then, and of course it says 10 items or less, and she has 643 items. And then it says positively no checks, and of course she paid with a check. And as she gave the guy the check, he said back to her, "Well, I'm going to need your phone number." And I said, "Don't give it to him. He's not going to call you anyway." And she smiled, and when we got out to the parking lot and she had unloaded her stuff and was putting her cart back, she just went by and waved and gave me a big smile. And you know, if you can do that on a daily basis, you're way ahead of the game, because it's a lot better than arguing over with somebody about who gives a shit, you know? And for those of you who are big thinkers, you know, I hear people say things that are really big thinkers. They'll say things like, you know, "When I get up in the morning, my mind is waiting for me, and it tells me, well, now I'm glad you're awake, and you have, I have committees in my mind." And if you're experiencing that stuff, let me tell you this, that's not your mind. You're its body. You know, if it was your mind, it would be doing the stuff you want it to do, you know. You wouldn't take that shit from your hand, you know. If your hand said, "I'm going to go get a soda," you'd say, "Hey, not without me. Just wait your turn. I'll be with you in a minute," you know. That's why it's called your hand, you know. But if you have that much trouble going on in your mind, then you got to start to realize that you're not calling the shots, you know. And so you got to get rid of that mind. And the best way to get rid of that mind is start to act in the now. And the mind can't act in the now because it can't be in the now. So that's why, and the reason it can't be in the now is because it's imaginary, and its problems are all phantom, you know. Alcoholic loses his job. Instead of getting another job, he's like, "Oh, I'll be in the street. I'll be living in a dumpster," or, you know, just phantom stuff. And the deal is that you got to get control of it. And the way to get control of it is start living in the now, because it can't live in the now. And I'll tell you why it can't live in the now. Because that's where God lives. And your mind and my mind that are made up can't live in the now, because that's where God is. That's why there's no problems in the now, because that's where God is. That's why these guys wrote in the book, "There is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him Thursday." You know? This is the now. This is where the game is played. And when you take the word now and you spell it backwards, it's won. W-O-N. You've won. Once you've learned to live in the now, you've won. And the deal is it gets to be a lot of fun. Because you're watching people who are, you know, they're like home-spinning future problems. You know, like, "So how's it going?" "Well, it could be going a lot better. You know. What's wrong?" "I don't know, but something's wrong." "You know, something's awry somewhere. I'm just not sure what it is, you know. I got a malaise, you know. I got a general malaise, you know. I have a plethora of problems, plethora, you know." And we keep changing the words because we don't want anybody to find out what we're really doing, you know. You know. And the deal is that, remember when it used to be a moment of clarity? You know, remember that? In the old days, I had a moment of clarity. A moment of clarity means you surrendered and you were totally in the now. And that's why you had a moment of clarity. You got a chance to see what was really going on. Well, now you catch a glimpse, or you have a peak experience. Well, the new buzzword is, I have an epiphany. It's like you had twins, you know. Did you go to Mars? You know, but we keep changing the words. But really what it comes down to is living in the moment. And when you live in this moment, it's amazing how fun it is. I mean, just look at the people in this room. I mean, it's like this is a photo shoot for America's Most Wanted, you know? And it's like you say to yourself, this is great. And the people here, there isn't a person here who couldn't come up afterward, and I'm sure there'll be at least two, and say, well, you don't understand. My scenario is a lot more critical than you're leading me. It's not all levity, you know. There's a lot of problems out there. I understand that. And, you know, I heard someone speak the other night, and they were talking about in the Oval Office, they have the rock, the moon rock that Neil Armstrong brought back. And whenever they get going in the Oval Office with problems, somebody goes and picks up the rock and tosses it like in the air like a little baseball. And that rock is 3 billion-plus years old. So in the context of your life and your daily struggle, sometimes you have to remember that. It's like, no kidding. And the deal is that it can be anything you want it to be. If you don't want it to be happy, you'll notice there's a correlation between you not wanting it to be happy and it not being happy. And you're going to notice that there are people who seem to be happy all the time, obviously not working the program. And it's like, well, you know them. No. And the deal is that it's one man's rut is another man's groove. You know, and it's all about perception. You know, it's all about perception. It's like a snail sitting on a turtle going, wee! You know, this is the deal. So hopefully I haven't contributed anything to your life. And I dedicated myself to doing just that tonight. And hopefully you'll learn to get a little laugh out of all of this. And remember, if you want what we have, then there are certain things you're going to have to do. And that's called the ritual. And if you have a problem, what you're really going to notice is it's your problem. It's not the problem, it's your problem. And if you look around, there's a lot of people who don't have that problem, which means it's not a very common thing, it's just unique unto you. And the deal is you can have it as long as you want, you know, it's like milking a mouse, you know. A lot of activity, very little milk, you know, very little milk. And the deal here is, or you can decide that, hey, I'm going to just do the deal today, and not try to figure it all out. And when I get up tomorrow, if I get up, I'm going to give Sunday the 13th major effort. But right now, I only have to do the 12th. I only have the 12th of October to do. That's my maximum effort. I think I'll hang out here and do that. And I want to thank you for inviting me to come out, because I love to see, you know, National Guard people. I do. You know? I don't know why. I've gotten older. They look like Boy Scouts, you know. I went over and was going to give the guy a buck. I thought they were selling something, you know. Until they go. And they all have that look now, like, I think it's loaded, you know. And don't worry about anything, because life is going to happen just the way it's going to happen, you know. Somebody once said, look at the lilies of the field. They neither toil nor spin, you know. And that same person said, forgive them, Father, they know not what they do, you know. And that's a clue. You think he's talking to me, Roger? You know, like, I'm really glad to be here. I'm going to leave you with a little deal that there's a guy that used to come in and out of my house, and he taught me a word which I'll pass on to you. And that word is namaste. And namaste is how people, Buddhists meet and how Hindu meet, and they put their hands together, and sometimes they don't even say the word, but sometimes they do, which is namaste. And namaste, loosely translated, means the God in me sees the God in you. And as long as the God in me sees the God in you, in fact, as long as the God in me is looking for the God in you, we won't have any problems. And each day will become its own life. You know, there's no place to go, there's nothing to do, and we have forever. Namaste.